This is Randy Thompson reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, the Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical, folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's musical trivia questions come to us from the website onthisday.com. Question number one. Back in 1954 today, Elvis Presley's first commercial recording session took place in Memphis, Tennessee. What was one of the songs that he recorded during this first session? Was it A, Blue Hawaii, B, Heartbreak Hotel, C, That's All Right, Mama, D, Can't Help Falling in Love, or E, Hound Dog? 1954 recording. And question number two, back in 1937 on this day, Benny Goodman and his band released a song that was especially well known for its drum solo by Gene Krupa. What was the name of this song? Was it A, Sing, Sing, Sing? Was it B, In the Mood? Was it C, Begin the Begin? Was it D, Mack the Knife? Or was it E, Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy? 1937. Hint, here's a snippet from this song. Sound familiar? So, what is its title? The answers to these two important musical trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions today come to us from that same website, onthisday.com. And today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of July the 5th, 2019. Well, it was on this day back in 1956 that Johnny Cash made his first appearance on Grand Ole Opry, and the Platters released the song My Prayer, 1956. And it was 12 years ago today, 2007, that Live Earth took place, the 24-hour series of concerts to raise awareness for environmental issues, especially climate change, featured more than 100 music artists on all 7 continents. Current and legendary artists across all genres performing multiple hits, including Feral, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Foo Fighters, Snoop Dogg, Lenny Kravitz, Melissa Etheridge, John Mayer, Duran Duran, John Legend, Black Eyed Peas, Enrique Iglesias, Kelly Clarkson, Faith Hill with Tim McGraw, Bon Jovi, and Sheryl Crow, to mention but a few, 2007 on this day.
Winnipeg had green eyes like yours, milady, like yours. She'd walk down.
Crosby, Still, and Nash's Guinevere introduces our folk music news. It's an article entitled David Crosby Looks Back Without Anger. This is written by Andy Green and published in Rolling Stone magazine, July 2019 issue. In a new documentary produced by Cameron Crowe, the singer opens up about love, music, and regrets. Near the end of Cameron Crowe's new documentary, David Crosby, Remember My Name, the 77-year-old singer looks directly into the camera and makes a startling admission. "I still have friends," he says, "but all the guys that I made music with won't even talk to me. All of them. All of them. One of them, hating my guts, could be an accident, but Roger McGinn, Graham Nash, Neil Young, and Stephen Stills all really dislike me strongly. I don't know quite how to undo it." It's one of many devastatingly honest moments in the film, which traces Crosby's life story from growing up the son of an Academy Award-winning cinematographer through his days in the Byrds and Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, to the 1982 cocaine bust that sent him to a Texas jail, up to his current creative renaissance and financial struggles. Along the way, Crosby talks about his many regrets when it comes to the way he treated his girlfriends, his bandmates, and his own body. "The way they do most documentaries these days is BS," he says. "People make documentaries that are just shine jobs. I wanted to be honest." The article skips down. Crowe says because we'd done so many interviews in the past, we were able to get past the niceties and get down to the toughest questions. For example, his take on the myth of Laurel Canyon is bracing and tough. The stuff that gets said when the tourists are gone and the cameras get tuned off, except ours stayed on. McGinn agreed to a new interview for the movie, but Young, Stills, and Nash don't appear. Instead, we see archival footage of them explaining CSNY's bitter breakup and why they haven't spoken to Crosby in years. Some of those burned bridges in Crosby's life are still fresh and smoking, says Crowe. He had a lot to say to them, and it's all in the movie. Crosby has little hope that CSNY will ever reform, but he hopes this film will help correct the historical record. Hopefully, this will paint a picture that's more honest. I just hope they see it. The documentary, David Crosby, Remember My Name, opens in theaters July 19th. Yo-Yo Ma playing Chopin's Polonaise Brillante in C major introduces our classical music news. You know, it's an article entitled Boys Play Trumpet and Girls Play Flute. But why? This is written by Ricky O'Bannon, published in BSOmusic.org on the 23rd of July 2018. Every fall, music teacher Alex Mueller watches fifth graders at elementary schools in Maryland choose an instrument they'll focus on. And almost every year, without fail, fifth grade boys want to play trumpet and fifth grade girls choose the flute. Obviously, there's something going on, Mueller said. Not many girls will pick up the trumpet, and few of his boy students opt for the flute. The question that has raised the curiosity of many who study music education is why. Is it a case of nature, where the character range or sound of the instrument causes boys and girls to be drawn to different orchestral roles? Or is it a case of nurture, where peer pressure and stereotypes guide students towards choosing to play certain instruments? If male and female students are innately drawn to different instruments and are happy pursuing them, it would be easy to dismiss the trend as something unworthy of losing sleep over. But research has shown that stereotypes about what instruments are gender-appropriate can influence the perception of musicians who go against that trend. A 2002 study out of the University of Windsor found that college-age participants asked to apply descriptive terms to musicians playing both traditionally quote-unquote feminine and quote-unquote masculine instruments judged musicians differently based on their gender. In particular, male musicians playing traditionally feminine instruments were judged to be less dominant, active, and poorer leaders than their female counterparts. In music, when performance is judged not only on technical terms, but also for intangible artistic qualities, these internalized descriptors of musicians based on gender might influence the perception of what we think we hear. Historically, some instruments have strong masculine or feminine associations. The French horn is traditionally linked with hunting, and composers who used it in the 18th and 19th centuries were often making allusions to the hunt. Trumpets have military connotations, dating back to their use as signaling devices on the battlefield, and many of the most visible trumpet players in the early 20th century, particularly in the United States and United Kingdom, came directly from a military brass band tradition. For many musicians, their instrument can be considered an extension of their voice. There is some logical simplicity that girls might play the higher-pitched flute and boys the lower-range trumpet because it corresponds in some way to male and female vocal ranges. But given the historic discouragement of certain instruments during eras where gender roles were more stratified, it is easy to wonder how many of those pressures are reflected in the numbers even today. At the top professional orchestral level, analysis by composer and programmer Subi Raman shows distinct gender preferences for certain instruments. Women musicians in 20 of the top American orchestras accounted for the majority of flute and violin players, as well as accounting for 95% of harpists. Male musicians made up 91% of double bassists and anywhere from 95 to 97% of trumpet, trombone, and tuba players. But numbers in the professional ranks start with decisions made in classrooms like Mueller's. Multiple studies show that boys and girls start to show preferences for gender stereotype instruments between third and fifth grade, and in some cases exhibit those preferences even earlier. A 2002 study from the University of Washington found that children as young as age five believed that saxophone, drums, and trumpet were boys' instruments, while flute, oboe, and violin were more appropriate for girls. Researchers in that study found that girls tended to be more flexible about what instruments they might play, but boys were far more fixed in their perception of instrument choice. By middle school, music is often a part of the social and personal identity that students are in the process of creating. The music that adolescents listen to, like the clothes they wear, begins to be influenced by friends and help define what circles they belong to. Similarly, what musical instrument a middle school student plays might become part of that same process in establishing their identity. Researchers have found that whether a student played a gender-traditional instrument or not, they were aware of those stereotypes. In some cases, students who played an instrument dominated by the opposite gender would say that stereotype encouraged them to go against the grain. A 2000 study published in Psychology of Music found that if students see musicians of both genders playing an instrument that is traditionally dominated by either men or women, they are more open to the idea of playing that instrument. Technology might also help teachers remove barriers by being able to immediately expose students to videos of accomplished musicians playing instruments. A YouTube video of Yo-Yo Ma masterfully playing the cello, for example. Put another way, if students are guided by social pressures and biases away from an instrument, that child might not enjoy playing music, and we all might miss out on a great musician. Choosing an instrument is a decision that opens a world of possibilities for a young musician, and limiting those instruments limits those possibilities. A thought that should keep classical music fan up at night is if, when any of those musicians heard in elementary school that their instrument was a boy's instrument or a girl's instrument, what if they had listened? Hey, in Music Research and Technology, we have this article written by Jesse Will. It's entitled Better Than CD Sound. This is published in Rolling Stone magazine, July 2019 issue. Streaming services were once instruments in the audiophiles world as non-stoppers because of their compromised sound. But that's finally beginning to change, thanks to the advent of CD quality and even higher res streaming. French company Ubuz is offering several million high res songs. Tidal now has streams with CD level sound or better. And according to Music Business Worldwide, Amazon will offer a better than CD quality streaming service before the end of 2019. Amazon calls the report speculative. Ubuz USA Managing Director Dan Macta credits an unlikely source with getting the high-res streaming revolution going. Neil Young, whose much-mocked early aughts audio player, Pono, aimed for the same fidelity Ubuz has now attained. Everything Neil said was true, Macta says.
Someday, when my life has passed me by, I'll lay around and wonder why you were always there for me. One way, in the eyes of a passerby.
Sugar Ray's Someday introduces our rock and pop music news. It's an article entitled My List, Five Songs That Make Me Cry. This is written by Mark McGrath, published in Rolling Stone magazine, July 2019 issue. The Sugar Ray frontman just finished recording the group's first album in 10 years. The working title is Little Yachty. The first song he mentions, The Beach Boys, God Only Knows. This song is religious experience, and I pray to the Church of the Beach Boys. It truly sounds like the Bible is singing to me. It's timeless. Then there's Bonnie Raitt's I Can't Make You Love Me. I can cry just talking about this one. It once got me through a breakup. The words are simple, but the way she articulates them is so beautiful. Carl Thomas's I Wish. This song is so brilliant it actually makes you feel bad for a guy that is cheating on somebody. Then there's Don Henley's The Heart of the Matter. Maybe not the hippest choice for a lot of people, but as a songwriter he's untouchable. This is a perfectly written song. Not a lyric is wasted. And finally there's Band of Horses, No One's Gonna Love You. This one's so powerful and yet so abstract, typically. There's a soaring chorus that just gets to you. Finally, we have this review of Black Pumas album. It's given 4 out of a possible 4 stars. True to their name, Black Pumas appear out of nowhere, ready to pounce, said Thomas Fawcett in the Austin Chronicle. An Austin-based soul project fronted by singer Eric Burton and guitarist-producer Adrian Quesadilla. The band gained a following as soon as it released its first single a year ago. Black Moon Rising is a sinister slice of psychedelic R&B that opens the group's debut album, a record that could just as well be the lost soundtrack to a gritty blaxploitation flick. Burton, a former street busker, sounds like a cross between Steve Winwood and Ray Charles, and the band's Motown-influenced sound consistently hits a sweet spot, like the finest soul music from the 70s and 80s, said Hal Horowitz in AmericanSongwriter.com. As the disc rolls on, there's an evenness in the overall vibe that feels a bit repetitive, yet it's so inviting, subtle, and enticing, you can't help but be sucked into Black Puma's heartfelt musical swirl. Because there are no weak cuts, the record's 10 songs fly by in the fastest 40 minutes of your life. So, how'd you do on today's musical trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, back in 1954 today, Elvis Presley's first commercial recording session took place in Memphis, Tennessee. What was one of the songs that he recorded during this first session? Was it A, Blue Hawaii? No, that was 1961. Was it B, Heartbreak Hotel? That was 1956. How about D, Can't Help Falling in Love? Well, that's another 1961 hit. Or was it E, Hound Dog? No, that's another Hound Dog, was another 1956 hit. And I was asking for 1954. Correct answer is answer C, That's All Right, Mama. As noted in History.com on the 1st of April, 2010, History credits Sam Phillips, the owner and operator of Sun Records in Memphis, Tennessee, with the discovery of Elvis Presley, which is perfectly fair, though it fails to account for the role of the blues figure who wrote the song he was playing when Sam Phillips realized what he had on his hands. The song in question was That's All Right, by Arthur Big Boy Crudup, and Elvis's unrehearsed performance of it, recorded by Sam Phillips on this day back in 1954, is a moment some regard as the true beginning of the rock and roll revolution. The sequence of events that led to this moment began when a young truck driver walked into the offices of Sun Records and the Memphis Recording Service on a Saturday night in the summer of 1953 and paid $3.98 plus tax to make an acetate record as a birthday present to his mother. Phillips knew that something was brewing in the music world, and he had a pretty good idea what it would take to make the pot boil. A white singer who could sing black rhythm and blues. However, the first several hours of the July 5 session did nothing to convince Sam Phillips that Elvis was the one he'd been looking for. After numerous takes and retakes, Phillips called for a break. Rather than shoot the breeze with his fellow musicians or step outside for a breath of fresh air, Elvis began to mess around on the guitar, playing and singing That's All Right, but at least twice as fast as the original. Through an open door in the control room, Sam Phillips heard this unfamiliar rendition of a familiar blues number and knew he found the sound he'd been looking for. Released to Memphis radio station WHBQ just 2 days after it was recorded, and then as a single 2 weeks later, Elvis Presley's That's All Right, Mama became an instant regional hit and set him on his path toward stardom. And the answer to our second question, back in 1937 on this day, Benny Goodman and his band released a song that was especially well known for its drum solo by Gene Krupa. The name of this song? Was it A, sing, sing, sing? B, in the mood? C, begin the begin? D, Mac the knife? Or E, boogie woogie bugle boy? And I played a snippet from this song as a hint. Correct answer is answer A, sing, sing, sing. As noted in NPR.org, All Things Considered, on the 31st of January, 2000. On the evening of January 16th, 1938, Benny Goodman took to the stage at Carnegie Hall. It was the first time ever that a swing band played Carnegie. Historians now look to this night as the moment when jazz gained validity from the music establishment. The Goodman Orchestra was well known in America from club appearances from New York to Chicago and from the radio. But swing had its detractors, too. Even so, the Carnegie Hall concert marked the moment when the history and music itself was afforded a sign of respect. The last number on the program, Sing, 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 is what Goodman called a killer diller, a 12-minute closer intended to get a crowd on its feet, jitterbuggin'. Drummer Gene Krupa sets the groove with his tom-toms, and members of the orchestra take their turn soloing, including a mournful one from Benny himself. But Jess Stacy's piano and Harry James' trumpet steal the show. So let's close with a snippet from the actual recording of this 12-minute song, Sing, 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 from 1938, Carnegie Hall. We've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. And as we leave you, remember these words. Kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Music Review, readily available as a podcast after the broadcast in the TRRS website, TriangleReadingService.org. Now, if you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me, Randy Thompson at 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.